Well, it's official. With no international agreements and ever-growing greenhouse gas emissions, scientists are asking if we're heading off the cliff into climate disruption, into the worst of all worlds. Our guest is Dr. Michael Jennings from the University of Idaho. Last year, he published a paper in the journal Global Policy. Its title is Climate Disruption: Are We Beyond the Worst Case Scenario? Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks, Alex.
So what is the worst case scenario as put out by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC?
Well, at the time that I wrote the article, the IPCC was still using the framework for scenarios. These are the future scenarios that they project. If we do this, you know, if our economy goes in a certain direction, if we shift to a high technology input, if land use happens in a certain way, and so a series of assumptions about population growth and where it might be, where on the planet different things may occur, the level of industry, the economy, the kinds of activities of human enterprise. And if you put these things together and you say, well, if we had high population growth and rapid development of technology and we shifted our fuel mix from coal to mostly oil and gas, we could expect this future scenario in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And so the key thing here is, what's the level of greenhouse gas emissions likely to be like in the future under different assumptions about what we humans do? And so they laid this out, and it was a very good, very usable framework that laid out, you know, kind of the, well, if we could just continue the way we're going, that was the business as usual thing, then, you know, we could expect this kind of result. If population growth became much more moderate, if we changed our fuel mix, then we might have a, you know, not business as usual, and emissions could come down.
There's a lot of optimism built into those IPCC predictions, but what did they say? If we just go on as business as usual and population does expand and all those things you've talked about, what were they expecting to happen by 2100 as far as temperature or sea level rise, do you know?
Well, that's the scenario that's commonly referred to as A1FI. That's the shorthand for the family that it's in is A1, and it's fuel intensive. If we just keep going, we're in a fuel intensive mode right now. We're using lots of fuel and all the different kinds of fossil fuels. And if we kept going, so let's assume that population growth, here are the basic assumptions under that. And this was the furthest out that, you know, they said, okay, we need to set a boundary, you know, a goalpost way out there that sort of defines the edge of what we think is possible. And that's if the population growth was medium, but world GDP, gross domestic product, was high, and energy use was high, and land use changes are high, and the availability of oil and gas is high, and technology change is rapid, and our fuel mix is primarily oil and gas. There's still a little coal in there, but it's mostly oil and gas. So those assumptions get us to what was referred to as A1FI, the fuel-intensive scenario. And the emissions, if you look at and you chart the emissions from that, it's the worst case. It's the largest output of emissions that people thought would be possible. And this was only 6 years ago they were thinking. You know, they kind of laid this out and said, okay, we're not there, we're not going there, but that's the worst case. It's kind of over in the corner.
And so they were looking at what, 3-4 degrees maybe if we went that direction?
If you run, okay, so the models, and I use particularly the Hadley models, if you take the models and run them out, so you run the atmospheric models, the general circulation models out, it takes us pretty close to 6 degrees average global increase in temperature.
Oh, my. Well, that's, you know, barely survivable from the scientists that I've talked to. But your paper suggests we may be already heading beyond this worst-case scenario. So is there a beyond?
No. There isn't, and there sort of is. In the recent IPCC report, the fifth assessment report, which they're still working on, but the Working Group 1 has issued their report, and they use a different kind of framework that's a little bit important, and some of it's just technical stuff. But the equivalent would be what they call the representative concentration pathway, 8.5, the most extreme, and it parallels the A1 FI scenario. So for all intents and purposes, they're pretty much the same. The point, though, is that if we look at emissions, then projected emissions along those scenarios, our emissions for the last 10 years have exceeded those modeled projected scenarios. So we are beyond, in terms of emissions, we are beyond that worst case scenario. And no, we haven't charted one beyond that. We just simply know we're on the outside of that boundary there. Now, one small caveat was that they did dip in 2009 because of the recession. In 2010, they shot back up twofold. It's a minor point, but some people say, aha, but they didn't. So I just want to say that's a small caveat. But overall, over the last 10 years, we have exceeded the emissions that were defined as the worst case scenario.
So we're into carbon overshoot, but how much more carbon can we put into the atmosphere before we go beyond the alleged 2-degree safe limit?
Well, if we look at it overall in terms of our modern civilization since the Industrial Revolution, we could generally pump about 500 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere before we completely destroy the biosphere as we know it. It's not that it goes away completely and becomes lifeless, but it becomes an entirely different kind of thing with a lot of uncertainty as to whether it wouldn't be a very nice place for human beings. 500 tons. So to date, from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we've already pumped in 370 billion tons. That leaves us 130 billion tons before we reach that limit, okay? And at that point, we're talking about not just 2 degrees, but more like this 6-degree or better scenario. Alex, the thing is that's really crucial here is, so if we think about even 4 degrees or 6 degrees, I mean, when you're in that range, you're almost in the so what, it doesn't matter anymore category. You're talking pretty catastrophic for future generations. You know, it's just absolutely staggering. If you look at the models and you run them out, it's just pretty darn hard to believe. Because once we really get above 4 degrees, some 4-degree projection, all bets are off because of feedbacks, because of Earth system feedbacks, like the methane coming off of the tundra or disruption of ocean circulation. And once those things really kick in, and they have started up, these feedback systems, we've set them off, and they are underway. And that's an uncontrolled experiment, and we really are uncertain. We're discovering every single day new information about these feedbacks that are blowing our minds. And I last Friday, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the U.S. just put out a paper that evaluated, and this is hot off the press, looking at the amount of change in the reflectivity of the Arctic Ocean in terms of the reducing sea ice. And so we all know about the Arctic sea ice and all that stuff and whatnot. The shocking thing here was that this study quantified very well that the effect of the shrinking sea ice to date, the thermal effect in terms of global warming, is equal to 25% of all the CO2 we've put into the atmosphere in the last 30 years. This is no small potatoes, and we're finding this stuff out every day. The thing about feedbacks is, like I said, this is an uncontrolled experiment, and most of our observations exceed the models.
So just looking at a little math here, you're talking about 500 billion tons maximum, and that even that is probably catastrophic. I believe that you said we were going through about 10 billion tons a year. That looks like 13 to 15 years. We'll have used up all the fossil fuels that we can, and then that's it. The party's over. Am I wrong?
At that point, we're in a catastrophic situation. I'm sorry to say that.
That's really, really close we're talking about. That's not 2100. That's a dozen years or more. And as you say, the Arctic sea ice is already in a record meltback. I did cover that new study last week on Radio EcoShock. It's terribly important. 25% of the global warming could come from that alone, the reflectivity of the sea ice. The weather's become extreme all over the world. Species are going extinct. So it sounds to me like we're already beyond the safety line. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we are. we are beyond the worst-case scenario right now. Now, can we pull it back? It's going to be really hard, and that window is closing on us real fast. The steps that we now have to take are so much greater than they would have been if we had begun scaling back our emissions 5 years ago or 10 years ago. If we had seriously taken it on, we would be in a massively different situation. Can we do it? Well, you know, this is going to be really difficult. We are talking about having to start reducing emissions by 6% now, this year. Okay. And if we do that, and if we were to work really hard on sequestering carbon with things like reforestation and agricultural practices, so taking carbon out of the air and putting it in the soil, by the year 2300, it's possible, it's conceivable that we could stabilize at 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Is this going to be hard? Well, yes. This is a very tall order at this point. It's conceivable. And so what I'm saying is it's not over.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I have a life to live. I have a grandson who has a life to live. So we're going to have to try however hard it is. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Michael Jennings from the University of Idaho. He published a peer-reviewed paper last year on our trajectory towards a worst-case climate change scenario. Michael, I'd like to move into another aspect here. I've recently interviewed experts on the possible economic impacts if we can't burn the reserves that big energy companies count on their books and in their stock promotion. If there isn't a new accounting, we risk a severe economic crash, the experts tell us, when those limits on burnable reserves do become a reality. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is really where the rubber meets the road. Well, right now, Alex, the total amount of gas, oil, and coal, of fossil fuel that's currently owned by somebody, okay, it's accounted for. It's on the books. It's held in reserve. If we were to burn all of that, it would be 2,795 billion tons of carbon. That's 20 times the 130 billion tons that we could still burn and be maybe more or less safe. That represents more than $20 trillion worth of investments. If you own some of that, right, why would you possibly own it? Only so you could sell it and make a profit, okay? The global economic models, the financial expectations of today, are predicated entirely or largely on not just the value of those existing reserves of coal, oil, gas as they're traded and whatnot around the world, but the economic yield of those in energy and goods that are derived from them. So the expectation, and this is not a light expectation, this is a predication, is that we will burn more than 20 times the safe limit. So your question is, if we were to pull back, that would have severe economic consequences. No question it would, but pick your poison.
Well, do we want to survive or do we want to make money? That seems to me what it comes down to, and the two are definitely intertwined. It's not easy. I'm not saying this is easy, and it's not just the big oil and gas companies that people may be picturing. I mean, we have dozens of national economies dependent on fossil fuel revenues, the U.S., Canada, Norway, Australia, Venezuela, a slew of countries in the Middle East. If they can't burn those resources, and many of them are experiencing population booms at the same time, what happens to those countries and geopolitics in general when climate change becomes so real to people that they demand change?
Well, there's no question that we're in for some instabilities. Okay, I would hazard a guess, and this is, you know, my business is on the science side of things, and particularly how biota, plants and animals, respond to climate. But moving forward into this, my speculation is that those responses are going to be very different among different cultures and different people, and the extent to which they have alternatives or don't have alternatives. No question, though, that in many parts of the world there are going to be great instabilities and really some pretty significant sacrifices that people are going to end up having to make. You know, this means us too. This isn't just some Bangladesh thing here. This includes all of us. But I think that how it rolls out in a geopolitical sense is probably going to be quite different in different parts of the world.
Well, now, you brought up the question of Arctic methane, and there's still quite a debate among scientists about that. One group calls it an emergency, and other scientists, like David Archer, say Arctic methane is still small compared to our greenhouse gas emissions. Did you have a chance to look into that while you were working on this paper, and what did you find?
I did have a chance to look into that, and there's been some, it is ongoing. I mean, the definitive work on this has not yet been done. However, we can't ignore the gravity of this potential. Right now, the amount of methane that's bubbling up out of the nearshore coastal environments, the subsea permafrost of the Eastern Siberian Sea in particular, exceeds all other methane, naturally escaping methane venting anywhere else in the world. So the quantity coming off of the Eastern Siberian shelf of the Arctic Ocean is larger in one, that one spot than anywhere else in the world. That is due entirely to the melting of the subsea permafrost. So that's permafrost. When the ocean levels were low during the last ice ages, that all froze and became permafrost. The ocean rose again and flooded that coastal area, which is a shallow coastal area, right? The permafrost remained in place, okay? But because the Arctic Ocean is warming up, that permafrost that's underneath the ocean in the coastal shelf is melting, and it's starting to release lots of methane. It's got the potential to release 800 billion tons of methane. And if it did, it would be absolutely catastrophic. We would see sudden climate change. So we don't know the extent. We haven't really been able to nail down the extent to which this is a risk, 98% risk, you know, or this is a 5% risk. We know that it's happening. We know that it's destabilizing. If it were to be destabilized at a large scale, it would be catastrophic. So we must pay attention to it. This requires some very serious attention. I think that really from a science standpoint, the final call is still out. It might just bubble away slowly over a long period of time. There's still a lot of information that we need to gather, physically speaking, you know, to be able to project with any real level of confidence the extent to which this is an immediate or perhaps a longer away type of thing. Generally, though, it's going to respond. So there's one of the problems is there's a nonlinear relationship here between the incoming sunlight and the warming of the Arctic Ocean and the Arctic sea ice itself, and the role of all that plays with warming up the water in the Eastern Siberian coastal shelf area. However, I can tell you this, that if you take measurements from satellite images of that region, and you easily can quantify that large concentrations of methane in the atmosphere across that coastal region. And then if you also look at the temperature taken from satellites of the region, you see that it's an absolute hot spot, right? That methane, in a localized sense, right, is really playing a role in heating up that region. So there's a series of feedbacks going on, and we're really not sure exactly how that's going to play out, but it is extremely serious, or at least it's potentially very, very serious.
Now, you pointed me towards a pivotal paper by Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA. It's titled Assessing Dangerous Climate Change, Required Reduction of Carbon Emissions to Protect Young People, Future Generations, and Nature. And there's two aspects of that that seldom get attention. The first is our obligation to coming generations. Can you talk to us briefly about intergenerational justice?
This question is ultimately one of intergenerational justice. And it really is about our moral obligation to future generations. This isn't just a remote possibility, okay? This is real, and it's here, and it's now. It's no fooling. It's absolutely urgent, Alex, that we change our use of carbon to avoid dangerous and possibly catastrophic consequences. It is profoundly a moral issue. You know, most people, I think, would agree that on some basic values, you know, the idea of a community of peace, liberty, and justice, and the inherent worth of everybody, and respect for this interdependent web of existence, of life, right? I mean, those are very basic kinds of things. And if we think those are important, we have to respond. This is the most serious and most important issue of our time. And we're absolutely on the threshold of this. The only alternative, Alex, is to sit and watch a very protracted, agonizing decline of civil society. And that's unspeakable, and that's not fair, and it's not morally right to young people and to all those who have yet to be born.
I'll put some links to this work of yours and of Dr. Hansen's and his crew of illustrious scientists that were part of that study in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. As we wrap up here, Dr. Michael Jennings, is there anything you would like to add?
Well, I think we've certainly covered it. It's so difficult to communicate the gravity of the situation and how quickly this is rushing along like a freight train out of control. And we have very, very, from a physical science standpoint, we have very little time in which to pull back from the brink.
Our guest has been Dr. Michael Jennings from the Department of Geography at the University of Idaho. His scientific paper warns humans are heading beyond any safe climate into a period of severe climate disruption. Again, I'll put links at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
It's a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.